second discussion session on information theoretic axiomatization of quantum theory. And here we have like experts in information theoretic axiomatization. And maybe I will start. It's like, as again, feel free and feel invited to interrupt at any time and go with your questions or remarks and so on. But maybe to like warm up the space, especially because it's like everyone is a bit tired already. And maybe I'll ask first Lucian on his comments, especially because like he is right now, since today, he's regarded as a founding father of the second wave of axiomatization. So I think this would be politically correct to start from him.
I don't have much to say. So it's just on the general two general comments on the program of operationalism, which I think is a very powerful way of thinking about theoretical physics. So first of all, the specific comment on the reconstruction program, the problem of trying to derive quantum theory from reasonable axioms or postulates or whatever, which I think has been very successful. In some respects, and there's lots of different really good things out there. On the other hand, maybe I'm channeling Chris Foots here, none of them are quite compelling enough to be you know, the definitive reason as to why quantum theory is the way it is. And my feeling is maybe we need even deeper postulates than the sort we had before. So one example, perhaps, of that kind of postulate would be the thing I referred to in my talk this morning, the composition principle. This is the idea that that the mathematics should reflect the composition. It should be a similarity between the mathematics you use to do calculations and the composition, the way you describe the composition of some objects. That strikes me as the kind of principle that might be useful. It turns out that principle is very strongly related to tomographic locality, which is an axiom that's used in many of these reconstructions. On the other hand, the relationship is the wrong way around. If you assume tomographic locality, then you can get to the composition principle. It would be nice to have axiom, if it were the other way around. So that's one thing I want to say is I think that the reconstruction program has been fantastic, but we need to somehow step it up a notch and go deeper and more fundamental and more compelling, and perhaps that will happen at some point. The second comment is that this general approach of operationalism, building operational models, general bodies of theories, and so on, I think we need to think in terms of invading other areas of physics. So not just looking at quantum theories, finite dimensional quantum theory, but to take on other areas of physics where there's an operational way that could be useful. So I talked about general relativity this morning, and I think that's a very fertile area for invasion by these kinds of approaches. Quantum field theory is another area where I think there could be tremendous insights coming from this kind of approach. So Robert's going to talk about an approach tomorrow, which I think is especially promising. Friday, sorry. Oh, yes, not the end of the week. And then, of course, the big holy grail of physics, quantum gravity. I think I'd like to see a sort of natural attack, natural approach to the problem of quantum gravity emerging out of this community. I think if we can contribute to that that problem, then we would see the ultimate payoff of what we've been trying to do. It's come up with new physics, and the problem has been very difficult for people in the past. And I'll leave it at that.
If there are like no direct comments or questions, maybe I'll ask a question. It's like, please consider this as a question to all of you, actually. One of the questions is like, there was already like a long time ago, there was this program of quantum logic started already from Neumann, later it started with Kirchhoff, and then it developed in various directions. And there was some structural problem with those at least Piron's and Mackey's approaches to quantum logic, which was a problem with tensor, with introducing tensor products. But let's assume that somehow this problem actually structurally had been managed in the past. And under this condition, you can say that quantum logic actually provided also a sort of axiomatization, especially like including the later results from the 90s, this Soler theorem and so on. So you might consider that this first program of some sort of providing some sort of axiomatization, actually it worked to some extent. But on the other hand, it also is regarded as a failure, as something that the results were not compelling. And they were not compelling not only because of the, like this issue of kind of tensor product, but also there was something more, I would say, both conceptual and structural that was not considered as satisfactory. And my question is like, is why we should not fear and why we should be like certain that the same would not happen with those current axiomatizations, that they will also regard it like, oh, these are nice things to say some, put some interesting mathematical assumptions into some sort of semantics, but at the end of the day, it will be not considered as valuable in like 15 years.
Oh, yeah, I certainly do fear that. I mean, I can see the whole problem just sort of amounting to nothing. I mean, this is why it's essential that we take on real problems of physics. We're trying to take these tools and use them to construct new physical theories that will need to be verified in experiments. Any approach that doesn't do that in the long run is not contributing to progress in physics.
I said a little bit of something. I think I have a different point of view from Lucien on that, and part of it might just be that I think some of the results are actually interesting mathematically. It's, you know, learning something about you know, the space itself, a joint matrices and its positive cone. We've learned some things we didn't know before. But the other thing is that we're starting to actually make contact with some of these notions from quantum logic again, which I guess maybe would just be further reason to fear. But the first two axioms that I described in the work with Cosman and Marcus on our axiomatization imply that the lattice of faces is an orthomodular lattice. So you get this structure, which, you know, some people would consider the definition of, or a good definition of quantum logic, but you get it also associated with some convex geometry. Not that this is the first time it's been noticed. It's certainly been noticed in Jordan. And then, you know, this covering law, which was one of the ingredients that I think might have been thrown in by Piron and whatever, and it's considered sort of unnatural. You know, Alfsen and Schultz came up with a little more natural characterization of it in terms of purity preservation, which, you know, I don't think Giulio was motivated by knowing about Alfsen and Schultz. He independently considered maybe a generalization of that to be compelling. I maybe consider it less compelling that I want to investigate theories without it, but we're getting a little more, by having probabilities and convex sets in the picture, we're getting a little more operational interpretation of some of these things that were just considered somewhat abstract, less theoretic properties. And we gave another interpretation of that in the context of these fairly strong assumptions that are stronger than just having any old orthomodular lattice. But another interpretation in which we showed this covering law was equivalent to not, the covering law for face lattice is equivalent to not having any higher order interference in this orbit. So I think there's a lot of interesting structure, and we may even end up, so part of the problem with that was also that I don't think there were a lot of really interesting, beautiful, from my perspective, orthomodular lattices with a lot of symmetry that were really known, you know, other than the quantum ones. And, you know, maybe some crazy stuff that, you know, is a little too far out for my taste. But, and now perhaps we're on the verge of maybe through constructing certain convex sets, actually, incidentally, constructing, you know, more of these orthomodular lattices that will have a lot of symmetry. And I think I can see that being an offshoot of my current research. And I think that would be really mathematically interesting, even, you know, whether or not it turned out these things show up in physics.
I mean, obviously there's tremendous value in or in new mathematics, and even in clarifying the existing physics. But the home run is going to be progress in physics. And that's what we're ultimately about.
So I agree. I also think there may be, you know, if you can see the quantum structure in there as arising from some higher order decoherence onto it, that might actually give you a reason for thinking maybe it is potentially reasonable physics that we're just not seeing. But who knows? I do agree with the idea that one should try to bring it into contact with other areas of physics.
So I also have my doubts about the reach of the problem, but maybe something that comes is that, well, even if people in the future adopt an operational point of view or not, apart from this problem, people have in the past, and I guess in the future, tried to construct modifications of quantum theory or modifications of other physical theories that involve quantum theory, because some people don't think that the separation of these things is a good idea. And now outcome that already exists of this problem, potential outcome, is that, well, we know that since certain combinations of principles in single out quantum theory, we know what cannot be expected of any other alternative, okay? So if, maybe some people will say, okay, I'm looking for an alternative that satisfies these things, and maybe we are in a position to say that, no, these things, this particular set of things, signals out quantum theory. So you are going to look for something a bit more weird than just this.
So, but I would like to put a little bit of a more positive take into this. I am personally very optimistic about the reconstruction program, and actually I'm pretty much an admirer of what has been done in quantum logic before. So I would say, in the comparison with quantum logic, I would say the good thing is that we have axioms that are easier to tell in the ordinary language. Because being an admirer of quantum logic, I have tried sometimes to look like, what are the axioms? No? So what are the axioms? Can anybody tell me what are the axioms of quantum logic? I cannot myself. Because they are very technical themselves to just to tell. So at least we have five or six axiomatizations that have a finite number of principles, like five, six, whatever, seven, eight, whatever. But these are principles that can be explained in a pretty plain words for most of the axiomatizations we have. So this sounds like progress to me. But this is said without any kind of triumphalism compared to quantum logic, because I think there is a lot of valuable work there, and we can only learn from the techniques that have been developed there. And I totally agree with our on that. The other reason for being positive, despite, in addition to the comparison with quantum logic, comes from the name of the program. So as Lucian put it, Lucian uses to call it reconstructions instead of axiomatization. Right? We are pretty consistent on that.
So.
And I came to appreciate this different choice of terms. So if you think about just deriving or axiomatizing quantum mechanics, maybe it's exciting the first time you do it. It's not exciting after you have seen so many axiomatizations. I mean, it's not the game of like being the first to get to some point. No, it's like, and I can prove the Hilbert space. Okay, check. That cannot be the real motivation of this program. So I like more now the word reconstruction, because what we are doing is like similar to what kids do with their toys. They first break them, and then they want to put them together. Because if you can put it together back again, it means you understood how it works. So we reconstruct in the same way as you would reconstruct the engine of the car or something like that. So you want to learn what is the kind of logical way of reasoning about quantum mechanics that allows you to put things together efficiently. And I think a good metaphor for that is what people are doing in biology. You know, you would like to reconstruct let's say, a living organism, you would start building up a protein and things like that. And of course, the first attempts may not look so exciting. You may end up creating a bird with a nose or head or things like that. But still, I mean, you are competing against billions of years of evolution. Also, you are trying to understand quantum mechanics, which is kind of now is like one of the most sophisticated theories we have, and there are even some issues that we want to invade our areas of physics. I think we should be a little bit, accept the fact that we are trying to do some kind of big thing, and we shouldn't expect, we should not just say that what we have is not good enough because we didn't completely reconstruct our living thing so well already. If I look at what we've done in this, from this point of view, it looks to me extremely successful. Also the fact that it's mentioned sometime that now reconstructing quantum theory is like you have pieces of a puzzle. I remember Chris Fuchs' talk in a previous conference about like now reconstructing quantum theory is a little bit like doing Sudoku or doing some puzzle where you have some pieces, then you put them together, and there are many ways to do that. I mean, even that, I think, is progress. Because we have a number of pieces that do work, and I like to regard this as a work of a community. Just to give examples, I don't know, I've learned from both Lucien and Marcus and Louis' work, the importance of connecting the sets of perfectly distinguishable states using reversible transformation. This appeared also in our talks yesterday. So this is clearly an important ingredient. May not be the ultimate axiom, but now we know that once you are there, you have a lot of structure, you can do a lot of things. And this, I'd say, is progress.
The idea of reconstruction involves something that I find very interesting, especially for the search for alternatives to test against it experimentally. It's the idea of classification of families of theories. Because, usually the way to proceed is to classify all theories, satisfying something and keep like making some sort of sculpturing and you get the shape of quantum mechanics.
Sorry, there was one more thing I wanted to mention. So another direction of expansion of these ideas that we have in the constructions is not to a new area of physics, but another area called quantum foundations. Because we tend to think that quantum foundation is just the things we are doing. But for instance, there is a pretty large community of people just trying to derive the set of quantum correlations. And this is a pretty different program from the program of axiomatizing quantum theory. And in that program, there is not yet a single axiomatization, while we have so many in the axiomatization of quantum theory framework. I mean, the connection between these two things has still to be explored, and I think there is a lot of value in what has been done in the axiomatization camp for what many people are actually trying to do with quantum correlations. So now I have the feeling that sometimes we are being too modest in kind of presenting the results of the axiomatization problem.
Maybe just I gave the impression that I wasn't optimistic and enthusiastic, but I'm extremely optimistic and enthusiastic. But so I think we can do, I mean, well, I think what we have here has been amazing, but I think we can do so much more. And especially if we start to take on other areas of physics, I'm very happy to see the work on thermodynamics, which is a bold direction, and there's also the approaches I mentioned, field theory, relativity, and quantum gravity. It's a sort of what we've developed in reconstructions is a set of techniques and ideas, but those techniques and ideas can be applied to other areas of physics, to do reconstruction or reformulation is another keyword. But then ultimately we want to get rid of the re and just do construction or formulation of some new theory level piece.
In asking how well it will work with axiomatized things, you could just look at the history of science. And I see two very different examples. A very successful procedure was, of course, ancient Greece. When the Greeks discovered how to do geometry of space, then they discovered that there are axioms and you could put all of geometry on the basis of your axioms and divide the rest. So that was an extremely successful policy, or not, without think that geometry is just a set of axioms. It is just a physics of three-dimensional space. Where they failed completely was to add time, much more surprise. Why were the Greeks not as active in measuring time as in measuring distances? But they were. They didn't understand time very well. So they didn't really understand dynamics of the camps. But another example where I think axiomatization would have completely failed, so there's hardly any mention of this in history, is imagine 150 years ago when in 1900 when people had the first ideas about atoms. Now imagine that someone come along with a program, let's axiomatize our understanding of how atoms hang together. But imagine what they knew about atoms in those days. They would have done completely wrong. They would have done something that the Greeks have done with the composite, well, with geometry. They would say that matter is quantized. That by itself can then we go from there. Do you understand atoms? No. The thing that was successful is you look at the laws of chemistry and you see, decide how, what does chemistry tell you about atoms? What does Brownian motion tell you about atoms? What do the light spectra tell you about atoms? And that, of course, was a successful way, which is much, much more pragmatic. No axioms about spectra. Please leave those axioms out. You would never understand anything. So, and of course, very important in those days was, please look at the experimental results. And then you can find and then the next step is to make models of atoms. And this is what I believe you should now also do today. You should make models of quantum mechanics, which model is more successful than others. And of course, we see in more recent history the successes of quantum field theory and the standard model. That was just modeling things. We were not too, well, people tried to axiomatize quantum field theory, but a failure. They're beautiful. Why actually we didn't tell you how to do things correctly, but by looking at experiments, that was the way to see how to construct good models, ask the right questions. So now I think about quantum theory, there's one question which is standing out for me. I'm totally unable to answer much more than that, because it should be obvious thing to try, which is what is nature's bookkeeping system? In particular at the Planck scale, we all suspect that the total number of degrees of freedom at the Planck scale are somehow limited. Space and time are no longer continuous, they're discrete, and finite, probably a lattice. We only push so many states inside a small volume, that's the Bekenstein bound, about how many states can you have, how many quantum states, what's the dimensionality of global space in the time and volume. But it's limited by the Planck length. At first sight, you think the Planck volume. No, that's wrong. It's a Planck surface. The surface of a volume tells you how many states can live inside. That's a very deep observation, but I haven't heard much about it, but eventually we should take that into account. And then try to make models of quantum mechanics. And you see the difficulties in making models. For instance, we have these beautiful symmetries of nature, in particular Lorentz symmetry, Lorentz invariance, but Lorentz invariance is a non-compact code, so you can always Lorentz boost further and further and further, ad nauseum, until the thing becomes totally ridiculous. If you Lorentz boost the particle too much, it starts to gravitate, it starts to do horrible things to space and time that you don't really understand. What's happening here? And on the other hand, the Lorentz invariance is extremely important, such as the other symmetries of nature. One symmetry is conservation symmetry. Imagine that you didn't have conservation symmetry. Then you would know, now if you know how to follow the laws of nature along one space of time, then you know where, how does everywhere else in the universe, because we just apply conservation symmetry. Say, well, if the laws are like this here, yeah, same there, same there, same there. The same with Lorentz transformations. If you know how a pattern behaves when it is at rest, you also know how it behaves when it moves, you can just apply Lorentz transformations. There's one thing that you can't discover that way, and that is what happens at extremely high energies and extremely small distances. And I came to the conviction that's because we are ignoring a symmetry which will do the job. The symmetry is at scale transformations, or if you make that local, it becomes local conformal transformations. If you can elevate that symmetry group into a fundamental symmetry of nature that you can use to figure out small distances from what you know of large distances, that would be a tremendous advance, but we don't understand how to do this properly. So these are all these very fundamental questions that we should answer. I think by asking such questions and by making models, models of quantum mechanics of all sorts, and by asking the right questions, simply in other ways, I think that's how we can make progress. But axiomatizing things, that's not very high on those things.
And
I don't know whether I can relate to this. These are all important questions, of course, and the hope is that probably by relaxing some of the axioms that we right now have, maybe we can have a broader structures and go into some of the questions you posed. But I would also go on, again, on a positive note. Like, there is no reason to be modest. And sometimes we are faced with skepticism, and this skepticism has to do something with, like, okay, you reconstruct quantum theory, but this is only on the operational level. And I think this skepticism missed the point. It is indeed on the operational level, but the very idea of the operationalism has this power to explain why quantum theory has a formalism. It does. And I think this is a great achievement. Actually, I would invite anybody with his own idea or interpretation of quantum theory to do the same. And actually, I was pleased to hear today's talk by you coming to the quantum formalism from something which he himself considers blah blah principle. But the idea that you don't react on the formalism by your favorite interpretation, but from some basic ideas come to the mathematical formalism. And now just a personal account, what I think that is an important feature of all reconstructions thus far, and that this is both strength and weakness of the reconstructions. And this is something which I would call like no physical labels, like liberation of physical labels. And this is that when we reconstruct quantum mechanics, we reconstruct finite dimensional, countable into dimensional Hilbert space with no physical labels. We don't.
Visible what?
Labels.
Labels.
Like, labels. So that we don't know, we don't talk about physical quantities like energy, momentum, position, or whatever. I think that when we started to do that, that was an important step forward. Because suddenly, you didn't know, you have a universal statement. You didn't need to know what the systems you have in front of you. And for example, one of the axioms, the subspace axiom, is something that I felt like I was pleased when I accepted. And this was partially an explanation for me for the quantum non-locality. The fact that there is, when you have two orthogonal states or two distinguishable events, it doesn't matter whether you treat it as a single particle or two particles, like product states of two particles. It's always the same physical state, space state, state of operations and measurements. And this is a kind of a meta-symmetry, which was only possible to arrive by not caring about locality issue. Okay? However, although this is a strength, it's now a weakness. Because at the end, maybe you would like to derive Schrödinger equation in coordinate representation. We can't do that. Or you want to go to the quantum field theory. We can't do it. There is probably a cheap solution to that, namely to add for every event a label where it happens. That's usually what basically I'm doing in quantum field theory. But there is maybe something more to extract out of an abstract Hilbert space. And this has to do something with the notion of closeness. And when we write, for example, when we have a singular magnet and we project a spin of a large spin, J, we, in the standard formulation of quantum theory, we know denote them like minus J plus 1 up to J. Why do we do that? Because in the abstract formulae, in the reconstruction, these are just orthogonal states, like J and J plus 1 are as far from each other, as orthogonal as any other in this series of outcomes. And I think we do that because when we go into the classical limit, that exactly corresponds to the neighboring events in a like classical limit of very large J's and coarse-grained measurements. So there is some non-trivial relation between the notion of closeness that we experience in a real world and the parameterization of our states. And this is also related to the work of Luis and Marcus and Philip and also work of Dakic and myself. And make, it's like very, when you look at the box sphere and the requirement of continuity, hidden actually, you think about operation that they are microscopic apparatus that you can rotate and that parameterize your possible rotation in real space that corresponds to the one of the cube. So maybe there is a notion of closeness there already, without necessarily need to introduce external. Personal account of what I feel is a strength and weakness of the problem.
About this metasymmetry that you mentioned, I think that this is something difficult to understand, and that it allows to define a notion of information that I think it has not been taught here, which is that, for instance, yesterday. So you can talk about information in the sense of what you use to make more accurate predictions, even past outcomes and things like this. This is the thing that I understand it's been mostly mentioned here. But there is another notion of information that is that it would include what we call quantum information. That is the idea that we can make, at some level, we can make physics in a substrate independent way. Which is quite interesting because, in principle, you think that physics is the science of substrates. No? It's about things, and later you can make computers with substrates. But later it turns out, at least when you study quantum theory, you can do, for instance, quantum algorithms that don't care about if you're dealing with atoms or photons. And this amounts to say that, it amounts to say that. You can describe with the same formalism all types of physical systems. And also it implies that everything, every process in a physical system can be simulated with a process in a physical system in a different substrate. And you would say, okay, it's only simulation, but at the logical level, let's say. But you're not simulating what would be the other things that you mentioned, the charge, mass, momentum. But I think that all these other things, mass, charge, momentum, all these things, if one way of understanding them is at the level of that they are just the way that dynamics works, okay? So charge is something relevant because how the fundamental dynamics of the standard model is, okay? And this is just a different notion of information, which is not, I think it's different than about gathering information and making better predictions, which is about we can understand this is the idea that you can understand the universe as a simulation because we think it's a substrate, but actually we don't know the substrate. We just infer the substrate because of the dynamics, no? And we say that things that are closed, things that are local, but this is just because of the dynamics that they are local. Okay, in the ontological model or whatever, they could be separated. It's just that for some reason they interact.
So you mean here that basically, like in those schemes, there is this, say, dynamic part, for example, postulating Hamiltonian, and things like mass, motion, and so on, is just, could be considered just as a mental imagery for the construction of a specific functional form of Hamiltonian. Yes.
Not a mental imagery, but it's just something relevant in that Hamiltonian. So So just to summarize, I would say that I don't understand why there is this symmetry, why one can make physics in a substrate independent way. And this is what allows us to make an axiomatization of just quantum theory. I mean, in principle, why one should be able to make an axiomatization.
So I want to pick up on this substrate independence that you talked about. So to my mind, the value of the axiomatization program is not so much in a particular set of axioms. Because I guess I don't really buy into a kind of hierarchical notion of justification wherein I say, okay, I have a bunch of things to justify, and now I've got these axioms from which to follow. Well, the axioms aren't justified, but they're somehow self-evident, and therefore everything's justified. I mean, I don't think those any set of axioms will be self-evident. So to my mind, I mean, what's important is more what you learn about the connections of different principles. So it sort of doesn't matter what the particular axioms are. It's sort of how different principles relate to one another. And the sense in which a scientific theory is justified is if it all hangs together coherently, so sort of bootstrapped. It justifies itself by virtue of the fact that it makes sense of the relationship between all its parts. And so I think all the different, it's very healthy to have many different axiomatic programs because that helps us get the connection between all these various principles. And so I see it as sort of, you know, as we do this, we will learn sort of deeper, more abstract principles about certain kinds of concepts. So to explain what I mean by that, I think it's useful to look at the history of physics and contrast two kinds of scientific revolution. So one kind is where it sort of happens overnight, somebody proposes a new theory, it overthrows the old theory, it makes different predictions, and then those predictions are found true. So we know that, you know, we have to get rid of the old theory. And the other kind of revolution is I would describe as a sort of change in perspective on an existing theory. So those revolutions tend to happen much more slowly. And so I think a good example is when Hamilton and Lagrange reformulated Newtonian mechanics in terms of action principles. That took a long time. But at the end of that road, we had a much better understanding of what the principles of classical physics were. We couldn't have gone on to revolutionize physics to relativity and quantum mechanics without that action principle approach. And I think another example would be the use of symmetry principles in physics and the use of information theoretic principles. And what all these things have in common is that they're principles that are really substrate independent. They apply regardless of what you're talking about. So I can talk about action principles for particles, for scalar fields, for vector fields, for whatever I like. I can talk about symmetries of classical theories, quantum theories, you know. And so the principles that underlie these things are much more generic than any particular physical system. And so I look at the axiomatization program and I see something like those slow revolutions that happened in the past, having to do with symmetries and least action. Except now we're having the slow revolution of information theory. So we're understanding what the information principles that underlie physical theories are and how they relate to one another. And maybe another pattern is sort of principles of composition. So if I look at the work coming out of the Coca group in Oxford and what Lucent's doing and what Julian's doing to some extent, you see that there's sort of principles of composition that are really quite generic that apply in lots of places, you know, whether it be about entanglement in quantum theory or correlation classically or in linguistics, you know, there's sort of notions of composition that are very abstract and they have certain rules. And so that's what really excites me is that we're getting a much clearer grasp of some of these abstract notions, which to my mind are deeper than kind of what's considered deep from the reductionist perspective. You know, the reductionist perspective is, you know, the deep structure is something, it's strings or it's fields. But I'm much more excited by deep ideas, ideas that span, you know, lots of areas of physics or, you know, maybe even broader than physics and other fields of science. And so I think that's what the axiomatization program can ultimately do.
So I mean, I think I feel that the substrate independence is a real strength, but also a kind of weakness of the kind of information theory perspective, because sometimes you lose track of the physics involved. And I suppose I kind of feel that if the Greeks worked on Euclidean geometry for 1,000 more years, that they wouldn't have discovered general relativity. for example, or the kind of non-Euclidean geometry. And so I always feel that the interplay between like the progression and the way of understanding the existing framework, but also being challenged by physical problems that are out in the world, seems to speed along that progress, foundational progress, even more, like a spur. And I suppose I feel that from an information theoretic perspective, there are additional directions which are interesting in relation to existing physical problems, such as applications of tensor networks in kind of horizon physics or more extreme regimes. And so I always feel like the interplay between the physical problems which are clearly there and also the axiomatization is kind of fruitful interplay.
Yeah, I agree that I would not recommend restricting these tools to axiomatic approaches. So I would say, Vizuse's point about conquering the rest of physics is that if we do manage to develop kind of an information theoretic perspective on physics that has deep principles analogous to the action principles or symmetry principles, then we can take those to any given domain, whether it be particle physics or cosmology or condensed matter, and we can, just as symmetry principles are useful there for doing all sorts of things, we can hope that our information theoretic principles will have the same kind of utility.
It's like clearly feeling put with that.
Yeah.
That's the last couple of years of development there, I think, are really exciting. Just as physics, not as, I like to play around with partial orders.
Yeah, I agree very much with what Rob said and some of the other people. I find it too attractive. I like the generality. But personally, I always come back to the fact that it's just one world we're trying to understand and has specific characteristics. And it has quantities which dominate our thinking about, like energy and mass and momentum. And physics, in the end, I find these are irreducible. So the general framework is very good and very helpful for the reasons why you said, but ultimately we're interested in the world that is presented to us. And I see physics transcending space, but I don't see it transcending the role of energy.
I mean, energy you have in classical physics as well. If you want to understand why quantum theory is different than classical, then this is an unimportant, at the first instance, is an unimportant issue. But then you would like to find out the quantum theory as we know and with the physical laws. Then I think that you have to make the next step, which might not be even specific for quantum theory. Maybe it's also for classical physics. No, what is energy? How are even operations define momentum?
I know, I agree. And a kind of question which to me is very important is what is in the end emergent and what is intrinsic? And it's a struggle. We're in a very field theoretic dominated era in which fields, and therefore space time and fields live on, somehow seem to be intrinsic. And recently, I'm attracted by trends which reverse it. So I mentioned relative locality, the reason why relative locality starts very much from your point of view in quantum mechanics and says that the fact that it doesn't matter whether you talk about momentum variables or position variables is a fundamental principle. But then we play with the idea that maybe the momentum and the energy variables are more fundamental and intrinsic. And when, this is why I said this complementary. One has to ask both kinds of questions, it seems to get to.
Maybe as for energy, as you know, of course, in classical physics, there's this Hamiltonian mechanism, formalism first described, Hamilton. And energy turns out to be a very, very central notion in classical physics. Without energy, we wouldn't be able to understand classical physics at all because there would be no stability. So as I see now, the Hamilton formalism is that
we want to understand the laws of nature such that they conserve energy, and energy should also be bounded from the law.
Mm-hmm.
And the Hamilton mechanism is a superb way of writing our laws of nature, which automatically do this job. It's the only way to write laws of nature which automatically do the job of preserving a quantity called energy. So that was a marvelous discovery by Hamilton that this is the way to do it. And it was an equally amazing discovery of quantum mechanics that we could carry this over to quantum mechanics and have the Hamiltonian do a very similar job in quantum mechanics as what we did in the classical theory. It's bound operator, but with an operator, you can find the evolution in time such that this quantity is conserved. The answer is Schrödinger's equation with the Hamiltonian generate the evolution. So, but maybe I want to have one. I want to have one other thing, which is that I want to make an unpopular remark, which is that normally people talk about quantum mechanics such that classical physics is all we understand intuitively, microscopically, the easy way, and quantum mechanics is something that is very alien for us, very different from what we are used to. I want to say the converse. I have the impression that quantum mechanics much more answers to our human need, that we don't want determinism, we don't want everything to be logical, we want some mysticism in the world. Quantum mechanics perfectly provides for all these needs. Whereas if, like myself, I want to say that actually I believe that nature is more classical than most of us believe, and I get very negative responses from everywhere that this is going back, and now we have this beautiful quantum mechanics. Why on earth do you want to go back to the classical world? So it's another down way around. Whereas I want to make a distinction between what is static and what is dynamical. So static is the information you have about the system. And that information we can write down in classically, but also write down in terms of qubits and tangled states and so on. But then the other question is whether dynamics in the world obeys these things. Can you make dynamically a classical state, a quantum entangled state? So the usual answer is yes, you can, but I have reason to put that in doubt and actually suspect the dynamics of nature can be rephrased in a classical way. And but to do that, you have to step away from your quantum prejudice, well, opposite to what people usually say about quantum mechanics, that I think many people are prejudiced in favor of quantum mechanics and in favor of so very much against, for instance, the notion of superdeterminism. We've heard in the talks I have had that we don't want to believe that the world is superdeterministic. That also the observer, if you want to ask a theory, the observer should also act in a way that is determined from its past. We don't like such notions, so we like to have the notion of tossing points such that the outcome that is unpredictable. Well, not in a deterministic theory, when you cross a coin, the answer also lies in your distant past, whether you like it or not. And that, I think, if you take that into account, you get a different view of what quantum mechanics might be and how you can possibly explain quantum mechanics as an emergent phenomenon from a theory which is more logical to my mind than quantum mechanics, which is the classical theory. But I'll explain much more in my talk about what I mean with all this, and how you can reconcile this with what we know about quantum mechanics today. But it seems to be a less popular standpoint as far as
my
experience
usually.
Yes.
Any comments on that?
Well, I'm just wondering, I'm probably one of the few people who is ambivalent about that sitting in this room here. But the reason why I'm ambivalent is because if it doesn't change my experience of the world, if you give me a formalism and say that describes the universe as a whole, and you turn the crank and I can explain everything that you see, hear, feel during a lifetime with that formalism, then I'm ready to accept it, whether I believe that that is the fundamental theory of the universe, or some other formalism is fundamental, that's a degree of belief that I would like to be agnostic about as a physicist, because if I cannot distinguish it, I would not want to make a distinction between the two.
Well, I think one should be able to distinguish it. But as I said previously, one should make models. And I like to construct models of everything I see. Model of particles, models of atoms, models of everything, including, of course, models of that show quantum behavior, whereas the original thing is classical. The quantum behavior comes from our way of looking at it, and not because nature is quantum mechanical, but because our approach to nature is quantum. And that I'll explain in my talk tomorrow. But in the meantime, I'm just saying that this is, as yet, still seems to be a minority point of view. But you're quite right. Of course, the burden will lie on me on showing to you models which do this particular job. And then you can ask, is it likely that nature is like this or not? That's the next question. You can make a model. But does the model agree with the workings of nature? That remains to be seen.
So I think there's room in the sort of foundational approaches for both the sort of fundamental, bottom-up approach where you postulate some ontological background of the world and then try to build mechanical appearances on the one hand, and the sort of top-down approach where you sort of think maybe from the point of view of agents and formulate general principles and try to build down to a physical theory. I don't see these two approaches as necessarily being in competition with one another. So in broad terms, fundamentally, I would certainly describe myself as an ontologist. I think there is some reality there in the background, and the ultimate task of physics is to understand what that is. A more practical question is how we get there the quickest, and then different of us think it's better to take this bottom up point of view or this top down approach. And I've been pursuing the in spite of my original, when I first entered quantum foundations, I was very much a kind of I was sort of thinking very much in terms of things like De Broglie and so on, very much a bottom up kind of guy. But I feel like this approach has been, this top down approach has been very successful. But there isn't competition. And of course, some people may think, well, actually, you shouldn't try to understand the world in classical terms. If that's the same as saying you shouldn't try to have a realist understanding of the world, then I disagree. I think ultimately, in the very long run, we want to know what the world is like. How we get there is about the strategy.
Much more likely is everybody should try whatever comes in his mind or her mind, and let's have all the models and explanations complete, and we will figure out. We will just pick the best. That's, of course, the way science always proceeds. But this also, I think, this question will be answered by whatever was thrown on top.
Can you just add that I think it's one of these, I agree that these two approaches complement one another. And it seems to me that this constructive approach, the model building approach, should take into account lessons of the top down approach. So to address these questions from earlier, should I treat energy as a primary concept in, say, my constructivist approach? I would say if I spent some time thinking about symmetry principles, that slow revolution, that abstraction, I think, oh, well, energy is a conserved quantity associated with time translation invariance, and therefore it has the same status as linear momentum and angular momentum. They're all conserved quantities associated with symmetries. And so I shouldn't sort of give it priority over these other conserved quantities. That would be my feeling, that what these abstract principles have taught me is that these concepts should be treated as sort of democratically.
Well, the difference is time translation. Of course, time translation tells you how a thing evolves. So it tells you something about the laws of nature. So that's why the Hamiltonian, at the same time, tells you something about laws of nature. Whereas translation is just symmetry. As I said, it's very important. Without translation, we'll be absolutely nowhere in our understanding of the world. But the Hamiltonian is a very special thing because it generates the law of evolution.
So,
both in quantum mechanics and classical.
I mean, I,
I mean, that's sort of one way of thinking, but I hope that, I mean, that one of the tremendous insights of general relativity is that we should put space and time on the same footing. And certain things like sort of canonical formulations of general relativity go against that spirit, attempt to impose this idea that you will probably be able to mission state forward in time. I think that's the wrong attitude.
Yeah, I think it's still an evolution theory about
the that's one way to get solutions, but the theory itself is a field theory. It tells you how fields are related to the point. I think you could take a different perspective on it, which is a more compositional perspective where you just put together lots of local descriptions and join them together in the right way. And that's not an evolution point of view. That approach is much more in keeping with the spirit of keeping space and time on the same footing. So I think it's more promising because that insight provided, because it was that insight that led to the original derivation of those equations.
Want to follow up on, make a point related to what Lee was talking about, Rob, you were just addressing. What comes to mind when I hear a pure information theoretic frameworks is and attempts to sort of give a framework for quantum mechanics is that what's missing is H-bars, Planck's concept. And that is something that isn't shared with classical mechanics, unlike energy, momentum, angular momentum. And, obviously not the particular value of Planck's constant, but the dimensions of it. So you do have non-commuting quantities, but it seems essential to me in quantum mechanics that it's position and momentum, for instance, that don't commute, and energy and time. And I'm wondering if anybody wants to talk about that. If anybody shares that concern, or if not, how do you see, that fitting into what you're doing? Well, in other words, if you gave that to different dimensions, you could have different quantities not commuting, and you wouldn't get anything like quantum mechanics.
So there's no axiomatization of quantum theory that I know of that uses H bar in a fundamental way. But Steve Bartlett and Terry Rudolph and I have a axiomatic derivation of Gaussian quantum mechanics. So this is only part of quantum theory, which is just the Gaussian state with some transformations and minimums. And their position momentum play a special role, and the axiom is an information theoretic one, and it says you can't have arbitrarily good information about position momentum at the same time. And the role of H-bar is it describes the area and phase space describing sort of the narrowest distribution that can just characterize your knowledge. So H-bar appears, it quantifies how much information you can have. But I would say that, the lesson of all that was that what's really important there is not so much, the value of H-bar, because I can do the same tricks for discrete theories where there's no H-bar. The important thing is the symplectic structure of the classical theory. So I would say the lesson there was that probably axiomatizations, one of the principles that's very useful in axiomatization is symplectic structure. That sort of carries over from classical quantum, and it ties in with other sorts of principles. Position and momentum is just one kind of symplectic structure. I can also talk about, linear optics and two field quadratures, which have symplectic structure. For qubits, I can talk about the Z poly spin observable and the X poly spin observable, and in some sense, they have symplectic structure as well. And that's what I think is the more primitive notion there.
Right, but it does seem to be. I'm not sure if this is running against what you're saying, but that your fundamental constant of nature has dimensions of action or angular momentum. That's fundamental to quantum mechanics, and is how do you see that as related to the symplectic structure?
Prefer to do things in with dimensionless quantities, I see the symplectic structure. Anything you tell me about kind of what's characteristic of position momentum, I attribute to the symplectic symmetry of classical mechanics.
Uh-huh.
Okay, let's do it in the temporal order, like causal order.
I wanted to connect with the last remark of Lucien about space and time. Because I think that in previous approaches to axiomatizing quantum theory, I mean, like thinking about quantum logic, all this, one important ingredient that has been missed, and that now in this operational kind of perspective is much more natural to incorporate space-time. And not only because we want to expand in other areas of physics, but also because the standard formulation of quantum theory incorporates the notion of time. It's very essential that you do a measurement, you have a preparation, you measure, then you might do another measurement. So you have a temporal order structure that's really important. But on the other hand, we know that, of course, that there's no absolute notion of time in GR. So there's a clash, and that has, of course, to do with the clash why it's so difficult to bring quantum theory together with general relativity. So it seems to me that now, from this operational perspective, there's an opportunity to incorporate the notion of space-time into this perspective of quantum theory in a much more fundamental way. And for example, Lucien's approach, the causal framework, for example, was going precisely the direction. Well, my own work also is going back to that direction. And I think that doing that will allow a much more wider applicability of the resulting framework than there has been so far with the framework that's always tied to this absolute notion of time. And I'm coming from gravity, so I mean obviously the hope there is that could help to bring the things together.
I just would say that I do agree. I do have the same concern about bringing H bar. The numerical value is really not important. But the problem is actually more serious. And I just repeat myself that we don't even know why we call position x and the next one x plus delta x, because two are orthogonal states. Just as x and wherever the other x is. So even if we still don't have a well-defined notion of kind of in the reconstruction sense of how you come to the continuous space and start to talk about neighboring points. This is also applies also for the phase space. So it's even kind of starts before coming to the non-commutativity between momenta. The other thing is that I used to be very optimistic about coming up with compelling axioms for the theory, but now looking at all of them now, this market of all possible construction nowadays, have axioms that are compelling to the extent that you can compare them with special or general. But I think we don't need to. I'm less optimistic, but I think this is a natural development. And especially if you want to introduce space time, or you give up absolute time, or even you give up definite causal order, how can you even hope that we'll come up with something which is compelling as compared to the axioms or the special relativity? I mean, these you can still. You know, teaching the secondary school or whatever, people will understand it's strange that light velocity is constant, all that is strange, but okay. And now we are at the level where we actually use the concept that are not self-explanatory concepts and make maybe composition of regions. I mean, this is still, from our perspective, after some years of experience in the whole business, something which is compelling. But because we want to have deeper and deeper and more abstract theories, we will have to go away from the everyday concept on which maybe the previous axiomization of previous theories was possible.
So,
the deeper significance of Planck's constant H bar, I think you have to see that in the context of quantum mechanics in the first meaning of the word, which is quantization. Things are discrete. And I have to go back to the ancient Greeks, where one other mind was aware of, they realized that something which seemed continuous then wasn't continuous. It looked like matter being continuous, but the Greeks introduced the quantum of matter, which is the atom. So that was intellectually a big step. Of course, there are no good ways to check whether atoms exist or not, but that came much later. But yes, matter is quantized. And then, when the thing that we now call quantum mechanics came, it said that actually energy and momentum, it, again, are notions which are not quite as continuous as we thought they were. They are discrete, but that quantum is not yet absolute. That quantum is linked to the quantum in time and position. So that means that the process of quantizing this world is not yet finished. I think ultimately we should also accept that space and time themselves are discrete, not continuous. And then we have a quantum space, quantum time, and the quantum of energy and momentum associated with that. Ultimately, I think everything should be quantized, in particular, of course, information. We like to think in still today's physics, that the real numbers play a very important role. But the real number form a continuum. And the problem with that is that to do infinitely precise physics, if you ever have that ambition, you would need to specify every decimal place of a real number. You'll never succeed in doing that because there's infinitely many decimal places. So you can't formulate laws of nature today with infinite precision because you have these real numbers. I believe is one day we will do away with the real numbers and replace them by integers. That's when everything is quantized. Eventually, not only integers, but also finite integers, integers with a bound, to say that everything is not only finite, but also limited by some bounds, so that we work with bits and bytes of information. As I said previously, at the Planck scale, we believe that the amount of information in a Planckian volume or a Planckian surface is limited by a finite number which grows either proportion to the surface area or to the volume. We don't know yet. Depends probably a little bit on how you look at things. But it's discrete. So I view Planck's quantum as the next quantum after the atom. But it won't stop there. I think we continue quantizing everything.
So just wanted to make a comment on what Steve said, but I feel embarrassed to do it right now because I couldn't agree more to the way you expressed it. So my comment would be just going down compared to the picture that you gave. But I think, except for the fact that we have an axiomatic approach to that, I think I would completely agree with all sentences of the words you mentioned now. So now back to my low-level comment. So I just wanted to make precise a terminology distinction. So in the axiomatizations that we have, strictly speaking, we have no axiomatization of quantum mechanics. Because none of these works worked on the mechanical notions. So we usually use the word quantum theory, so axiomatization of quantum theory, to mean something that maybe for physicists would be called the kinematics. So we are just describing the possible states, the possible evolutions, and the possible measurements. We're not saying anything about how which particular evolutions are selected by nature. So that part, as far as I know, has not been axiomatized anywhere. So in a sense, I mean, you are pointing out something that has to be done, and it's exciting to do it. I wish actually I had myself done a better job at doing this part already, but it's not an easy thing to do. And it is kind of one of the next directions, I think, of the axiomatization approach, to axiomatize mechanical notions.
Let me just comment on this, that there was apparently some work done in the past on so-called rational mechanics by Truesdell and so on. There was some work on attempts of doing, maybe Ariel knows more. I mean, James knew a lot about this, but some referred to it that way. So there was some also kind of approaches to make kind of doing the sort of axiomatic approach with good semantics for mechanics. So there is some knowledge about this in fact.
But this amount seems to come from a different tradition than the one of generalized probabilistic theories.
Oh, absolutely.
So I'm saying, for the project in the kind of generalized probabilistic theory, it has always been quantum theory, so kinematical aspects. And there are indeed other aspects that are proposed, mostly as far as I know, from the information geometry.
Yeah.
And probably now it's time to connect the two things and see if we can get something useful out of the connection.
Actually, I have a comment on this because like when you look in FAS, for example, the work of Mielnik, it's like that he considered not only just convex sets, but actually he considered as very important to impose like a distance structure, which was more or less some sort of transition amplitude thing. And there was like all development, not very popular, but intense, like Guder, Pulmanova, and so on, transition probability spaces. And there was even a successful work by Lanzmann on axiomatizing quantum mechanics as a transition probability space with Poisson structure, so it would be kind of close to the heart of at least of this what Rob thought. And also it's somehow related to this last work of Markus and Kozmina and Howard on like adding energy this Hamiltonian structure as a part of axiomatization. So there is something like necessity of consideration of dynamical notion. Okay, possibility of consideration of dynamical notions as part of axiomatization problem. I mean, there is, if you rotate the kaleidoscope of axiomatizations, at some rotation you see that dynamics pops out. It's also interesting that in other cases it's not so clear where it is. So it's actually interesting to what extent you can replace dynamics with something else, like for example by tensor product structure. For example, like this passage from Jordan algebras to sister algebras or from Menon algebras, it can be realized both by assuming Hamiltonian structure, assuming Lie brackets somewhere there, as Alsen Schultz did, and like this last paper also, Markus Horowitz and Kozmin paper appears, but also you can assume that there are specific that you want to have a tensor product with qubits, and then you also restrict this also as condition that restricts Jordan structure to sister structure. So there is like, it's interesting that either you consider dynamics as a constraint or tensor products, which you consider pretty as kinematic structure. So it's interesting that the kaleidoscope changes the things between things that we thought as very different qualitatively.
Oh. I just wanted to add something to what Gerard said, which all of which, like Giulio, I agree with every sentence, except maybe one where it said that we should have an absolute bound on integers. That suggests to me that maybe it's guaranteed that the universe will come to an end at a certain time. I'm not sure if I want to believe that. But leaving that aside, the other thing I wanted to add was H-bar, of course, already points to a discrete scale for space-time. If you put it together with the gravitational constant, of course, you get the Planck length. So it may be that even we don't even need, in some sense, not even to go beyond H-bar, or at least in the sense that it's already pointing beyond itself, and it's showing us where this discreteness can be expected.
And the only thing is you don't understand that logic so very well. So that is that's the that has to.
So I wanted just to go back to what were the goals of the construction, how far we are. concluding thoughts on myself. So one of the goals was to come up with something like what would be a plausible axioms for and depending on your notion of plausibility, we have reached this or not. I'm optimistic with this on that aspect of the reconstructions. The other, which I hope would be actually very fruitful, and it turned out not to be, was to look at, by omitting one or more axioms, looking at the more general structures, which will lead to this general probabilistic theory, and then to test quantum theory against those theories. Because thus far, we only have tests of classicality. When we test the Bell inequality violation, we test whether the theory is classical or non-classical. It happens that we have one non-classical theory, it's quantum theory. But then I thought maybe there is a kind of tennis on quantum theory in that aspect, that maybe there are like bounds, I don't know, to square root of 2, and maybe we can have a meaningful theories that would break these bounds and then test quantum theory. Or some of the axioms on which we based the reconstruction test against the nature. But it turned out that we don't have a single, as far as I understand, a single functioning general probabilistic theory, and which speaks for uniqueness of quantum theory. So even somehow, that's maybe the most interesting product of the whole reconstruction. It's very hard to come up with something which, I mean, you get partial results like theories in which you don't have entanglement and so on, but they are kind of very weak in the structure. Okay, so I don't know, but I feel that this didn't work. And after all, I mean, experimentally didn't take on that, except for the Gregor Weiss experiment that tests like continuum quantum mechanics. I don't know any other, or free slip experiment. Thank you very much. Good that you are here. And so this is another test, which I know, but compared with the numerous tests of contextuality and non-locality, it's about percentage. Then there is another thing, and I think this might turn out as a useful, and that's where I'm most interested, is to be as conservative as possible with respect to the existing quantum framework, and yet be more general, to incorporate, for example, situations where you don't have well-defined causal order. That's something Lucien was telling us, and maybe tomorrow we'll hear something about that, and my talk was about that. I'm enthusiastic about that. Because it is so conservative, and we see a richness already now of structure, maybe nature will not follow this, of course. And then there is the most radical one. And actually, Giulio was talking about that on the last discussion. And this is to actually weaken not some of the axioms, but something which we implicitly assume from the very beginning, and that's the notion of probability. And so if we think like historically, we started from something which was the strongest predictability of our theory, deterministic theories. And the next step was introducing probabilities, for which this has a strong indication that it's in a sense irreducible. Can we go even beyond that, and even that week, and say, well, not even probabilities are well defined, or whatever the notion of probability will be, but really just have the weakest possible notion of some predictability which is not probabilistic. I mean, this is the most radical, I wouldn't know even how to start this. Model quantum mechanics resembles something.
You have
paper. You put one paper in this. Okay, so that's the starting point.
Hey, maybe if there are some immediate comments, then feel free to add.
Can I wrap up comments?
Yes.
So we are often mentioned this idea of like measuring how successful are axiomatizations in terms of how natural are the axioms. I would insist that this may not be the right criterion always. So one thing is like, I mean, I don't know, you see something, you see kind of intelligent behavior in nature, and you would find some axiom that tells you that it's natural that you should see that. And one thing is to axiomatize in order to be able to reveal the things. So like, in artificial intelligence, people would like to have some principles from which they can actually build robots or things like that. So I would say that axiomatizing thing, I mean, one virtue of an axiomatization is also to have principles that work, in the sense that allow you to construct protocols, to derive pieces of physics like dynamics, thermodynamics, field theory, gravity. this kind of practical approach to axiomatizations is something that, that I would like to advertise more. More than we should find a set of axioms that are so natural that everybody would agree on that, and then necessarily we should have quantum mechanics. As though quantum mechanics is not a surprising theory to have, as though all the mysteries in the end should kind of boil down to something that is self-evident at all. I don't think necessarily we are looking for self-evident axioms, and we shouldn't always judge axiomatizations based on how self-evident are the axioms. In a sense, if they were so self-evident, we would have had nothing to learn from quantum theory.
I think that this is a good conclusion for this organized part. Thank you very much for being a part of the panel, and also thank you for participating in this organized part. And let's just move to the unorganized part. Thanks.